This is VOA News. I'm Joe Ramsey. NATO's Secretary General accused Russian President Vladimir Putin of trying to weaponize winter by forcing the Ukrainians to, quote, freeze or flee and dividing the alliance.
Our meeting here in Bucharest is sending a strong message of NATO unity and of sustained support for Ukraine.
NATO foreign ministers met in Romania to drum up support for Ukraine as Russia bombards energy infrastructure ahead of the frigid winter. There's a new report from the Pentagon on China's military strategy. VOA's Marissa Melton reports.
The Pentagon said Tuesday that China will likely have a stockpile of 1,500 nuclear warheads by 2035 if it continues at its current pace. The figure underscores U.S. concerns about China's intentions for its nuclear arsenal. Pentagon Press Secretary Pat Ryder.
The more proliferation there is, the more concerning it is, the more destabilizing to the region it is.
China says its arsenal is dwarfed by those of the United States and Russia. Marissa Melton, VOA News.
U.S. militia leader Oath Keepers founder Stuart Rhodes has been convicted of seditious conspiracy for a violent plot to overturn Democrat Joe Biden's presidential win, handing the U.S. Justice Department a major victory in its massive prosecution of the January 6, 2021 insurrection. A Washington, D.C. jury on Tuesday found Rhodes guilty of sedition after 3 days of deliberations. The nearly two-month-long trial showcased the far-right extremist group's efforts to keep Republican Donald Trump in the White House at all costs. Find more on our website, voanews.com, or follow us on the VOA mobile app. This is VOA News. U.S. President Joe Biden praised the national soccer team on Tuesday after its 1-0 win against Iran during Qatar's World Cup.
USA, USA. That's a big game, man. When I spoke to the coach and the players, I said, you can do this. They went, they did it. God love them.
Biden was at a semiconductor facility in the northern U.S. state of Michigan when he ran back to the stage to congratulate the team. The United States triumphed on the pitch over the longtime adversary Iran in a World Cup showdown overshadowed by protests raging in Iran and laced with decades of political tension between the two countries. A new study says gun deaths in the U.S. hit the highest levels in decades, the AP's Ed Donahue reports.
The research published by JAMA Network Open shows gun-related homicide and suicide rates both rose 8% last year, each hitting levels last seen in the early 1990s. The rate among women is growing faster than that of men. Among black women, the rate of firearm-related homicides more than tripled since 2010. Experts say reasons for the increase in gun deaths could include disruption of people's work and personal lives during the pandemic, higher gun sales, stress, and mental health issues. I'm Ed Donahue.
A Walmart employee in the eastern U.S. state of Virginia who says she barely missed being shot in gunfire that left six coworkers dead has filed a $50 million U.S. dollar lawsuit. AP correspondent Norman Hall reports.
The lawsuit filed in court in Chesapeake, Virginia, says Walmart allegedly continued to employ the shooter, a store supervisor, despite what it calls Andre Bing's known propensities for violence, threats, and strange behavior. The plaintiff is Danya Priolo. She alleges that she has experienced post-traumatic stress disorder, including physical and emotional distress. Walmart, which is headquartered in Bentonville, Arkansas, said in a statement that it was reviewing the complaint and will respond as appropriate in court. I'm Norman Hall.
Countries have begun to discuss a future global plastics treaty which would cut pollution, some hope entirely by 2040, at UN talks in Uruguay this week, with many states calling for curbs on plastic production as a way to reach that goal. United Nations members agreed in March on a resolution to create the world's first treaty to deal with the scourge of plastic waste, which extends from ocean trenches to mountaintops, although there's a divergence on how to proceed. And Twitter's rolled back a policy that was aimed at tackling misinformation related to the COVID-19 on the social media platform, lending itself to the risk of a potential surge in misinformation. I'm Joe Ramsey. VOA News.
Today is Wednesday, November 30th, and this is VOA's International Edition, and I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, the president of South Korea warns North Korea of the consequences if Pyongyang goes ahead with a nuclear test.
What I can tell you is that our response would include something that has not been seen in the past.
And Hussein Barsh, the head of the Foreign Policy Institute, an Ankara-based research organization, says Italy and Turkey have found firm common ground.
They don't talk about certain values, democratic values. They talk about the religious values. They talk about the nationalistic values. And I think they will understand each other much better than the other.
Also, the defense has rested its case as the tax fraud trial against the Trump Organization reaches its final stages. We'll have these stories and more next. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol is warning of an unprecedented joint response with allies if North Korea goes ahead with a nuclear test. He's also urging China to help dissuade the North from pursuing the banned development of nuclear weapons and missiles. Reuters reporter Flora Bradley Watson has the story.
South Korea's leader had a stark warning for the North on Monday. In a wide-ranging interview with Reuters, President Yoon Suk-yeol said that if Pyongyang went ahead with a nuclear test, there would be an unprecedented response from Seoul and its allies. But he gave no specifics.
What I can tell you is that our response would include something that has not been seen in the past. It would be extremely unwise for North Korea to conduct a seventh nuclear test.
Yoon's comments come as officials from his country and the U.S. warn that North Korea may be preparing to resume testing nuclear weapons for the first time since 2017. He also urged China, as North Korea's closest ally, to do more to influence Pyongyang. And noted how countries in the region, including Japan, have been pushed to increase their defense spending. More U.S. warplanes and ships have also been deployed.
I believe that China has enough capability to affect North Korea's decision, not only in military aspects but also economically. However, it is up to China's decision to what extent it will influence North Korea and how much it's going to contribute to the peace and stability of the Korean Peninsula.
2022 has been a record year for North Korea's missile tests, including the launch of an intercontinental ballistic missile this month, which Tokyo said landed 130 miles off the coast of Japan. Such tests have overshadowed multiple gatherings of international leaders. Undeterred by the backlash received, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un said this week his country intends to have the world's most powerful nuclear force.
That was Reuters reporter Flora Bradley Watson. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and Italy's newly elected far-right Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni appear to be finding unlikely common ground on issues relating to Africa and migration. The relationship with Meloni is the latest in a list of strong partnerships that Erdogan has been working to build with European far-right leaders. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
At the first meeting of Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and Italy's Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni, there were smiles and a warm handshake on the sidelines of the G20 gathering in Indonesia. Despite their diametrically opposed policies, including Meloni's call to freeze mosque construction in Italy and Erdogan's positioning himself as a defender of Muslim rights, some analysts say the two have found firm common ground. Hussein Barja is the head of the Foreign Policy Institute, an Ankara-based research organization.
Tayyip Erdogan is Islamist and Turk. Meloni is Christian and Italian, so they understand each other much better. They don't talk about certain values, democratic values. They talk about the religious values. They talk about the nationalistic values. And I think they will understand each other much better than the other.
One of Meloni's priorities is to stem migration from Africa, much of which comes through Libya. Turkey has strong ties with Libya's government of national unity, giving Erdogan an important bargaining chip, say analysts, including Aya Buwella, a visiting lecturer on international relations at the Hellenic National Defense College in Athens.
Turkey now has a base in West Libya. It controls all critical infrastructure in West Libya. And as you know, West Libya is a very important human trafficking point to Europe. So Turkey now has a base in North Africa.
But with tensions between Turkey and Greece rising over territorial disputes, Rome could pay a high cost for deepening ties with Ankara. Turkey also has strained relations with Egypt, an important trading partner of Italy. Jalel Hajawi at the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crime.
I think Italy has not forgotten that it's a European nation. I wouldn't say that Italy, I mean, obviously, Italy also has a lot of hydrocarbons business going with Egypt. It's not in the business of angering Egypt particularly. So I would really keep a distinction between Turkey and Italy. Italy is not very happy to see this level of controversy.
Meloni and Erdogan both have strained relations with French President Emmanuel Macron over incidents including one in which Italian authorities recently refused to allow a ship carrying migrants to dock. The vessel then had to go to France, where the migrants finally disembarked. The Turkish and Italian leaders also aim to challenge France's lucrative economic interests in Africa. Erdogan also has years of experience working with far-right European leaders, like Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orban. Senem Aydınduzgit is a professor of international relations at Sabancı University near Istanbul.
He actually has a good working relationship with Islamophobe autocrats, like Orban, for instance. So you see, it doesn't matter if she's far right. And I think it might even work more to his interest that she is, because the current Turkish government is quite happy to see a Europe that's disunited, that is devoid of so-called values.
Istanbul's newest bridge was built by an Italian company. Trade is the bedrock of Italian-Turkish ties, which the two countries' leaders appear ready to build upon. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
NATO's chief has reaffirmed the alliance's commitment to Ukraine ahead of a meeting of NATO foreign ministers in Romania. Associated Press correspondent Karen Chamas reports.
NATO's chief has reaffirmed the alliance's commitment to Ukraine ahead of a meeting of NATO foreign ministers in Romania. Speaking ahead of the meeting, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said the possibility for Ukraine to join the bloc was still there.
The NATO door is open.
However, Stoltenberg asserted that Ukraine had more urgent needs.
We stated that Ukraine will become a member. I expect allies to reiterate also that position. However, the main focus now is on supporting Ukraine.
Most of all, the war-battered country will need electrical components for its devastated power transmission network ahead of a blistering winter. Stoltenberg accused Russia of deliberately attacking the energy infrastructure at a vital time for Ukraine.
President Putin is trying to use winter as a weapon of war.
I'm Karen Chamas.
Australia's national terrorism threat level is being lowered from probable to possible, but intelligence officials are warning that a deadly attack could still happen in the next 12 months. Phil Mercer reports.
Australia has five official levels under its national terrorism threat classification system, ranging from certain to not expected. The alert level has been in the middle range at probable since 2014, after the emergence of the Islamic State militant group in the Middle East. It has now been lowered to possible. This means the authorities believe that while Australia remains a potential target for terrorist attacks, there are fewer extremists intending to carry out an attack. The de-escalation in the terror threat level was announced Monday by the Director General of ASIO, the Australian Security and Intelligence Organisation, Mike Burgess. He told reporters in Canberra that the country must remain vigilant.
While ASIO considered all of these factors when deciding to lower the terrorism threat level, I can almost guarantee it will need to go up again at some point in the future. But that is no reason to refrain from lowering it now. But it is a reason for ASIO to stay on the case, to continue our counter-terrorism effort, to give Australian people the safety, security and assurance they deserve.
The ASIO boss also warned that there were individuals still fantasising about killing other Australians, still spouting their hateful ideologies in online chat rooms. ASIO has publicly reported 11 terrorist attacks in Australia since 2014. 21 significant extremist plots had also been detected and disrupted. Burgess has acknowledged Australia's security and intelligence agencies were increasingly focused on the rising threat posed by foreign interference and espionage. He said the recent repatriation of Australian wives, widows and children of dead or imprisoned Islamic State fighters from Kurdish-run detention camps in Syria had been accounted for in the decision to lower the domestic threat level. Home Affairs Minister Claire O'Neill told local media Monday that the Australian government and security agencies would remain vigilant. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
The United States' highest court will take up a dispute over deportation policy. Associated Press correspondent Jennifer King has the details.
The Supreme Court will hear arguments today in a legal fight over immigration officers' discretion in deciding which people in the country illegally should be deported. Federal appeals courts in Cincinnati and New Orleans reached conflicting decisions over Department of Homeland Security guidance issued in September of 2021 after President Biden was elected. The directive prioritized those who posed the greatest risk, pausing deportations unless individuals had committed acts of terrorism, espionage, or egregious threats to public safety. While a federal appeals court in Cincinnati overturned a district judge's order that put the policy on hold, Texas and Louisiana sued and won to freeze the guidance under a nationwide court order, saying it violated federal law and they would face added costs from having to detain people with criminal records. It's the latest example of a strategy that has succeeded in slowing Biden administration initiatives by going to Republican-friendly courts. Jennifer King, Washington.
The defense has rested its case as the tax fraud trial against the Trump Organization reaches its final stages. Associated Press correspondent Jackie Queen reports.
Closing arguments are slated for later this week in the criminal tax fraud trial against Donald Trump's real estate empire. Defense lawyers say prosecutors are seeking to punish the entire company for one person's scheme to avoid personal income taxes on company perks like apartments and luxury cars. Finance Chief Alan Weisselberg has already pleaded guilty to taking $1.7 million in unreported compensation, and he testified against the Trump Organization. But defense lawyers blame Weisselberg and longtime accountant Donald Bender, suggesting Bender should bear the blame for not catching the fraud. There are no allegations against the former president nor members of his family. I'm Jackie Quinn.
Former Vice President Mike Pence is calling on Trump to apologize for some recent and controversial dinner guests. Lisa Dwyer of the Associated Press has the story.
A growing number of Republicans, including former Vice President Mike Pence, are criticizing Donald Trump for dining with a Holocaust-denying white nationalist and the rapper formerly known as Kanye West. Pence says that the former president demonstrated profoundly poor judgment when he met last week at his Mar-a-Lago club with West, who is now known as Ye, as well as Nick Fuentes, a far-right activist with a long history of making anti-Semitic and white nationalist remarks. Trump has said he did not know who Fuentes was before the meeting, but has so far refused to denounce his views. I'm Lisa Dwyer.
A top Qatari official involved in the country's World Cup organization has put the number of workers' deaths for the tournament between 400 and 500 for the first time, a drastically higher number than any other previously offered by Doha, according to the Associated Press. The comment by Hassan Al-Taudi, the Secretary General of Qatar's Supreme Committee for Delivery and Legacy, appeared to come off the cuff during an interview with British journalist Piers Morgan. But that figure hasn't been discussed publicly by Qatari officials previously. Those released figures put the total number of deaths at 40. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Yehyes Wahib in Washington. In World Cup football news, England, the United States, the Netherlands, and Senegal all scored victories Tuesday to advance to the knockout round of 16 in Qatar. For more details, we join our VOA's on-goal sports analyst, Mokbilia Barro, with this update on the exciting teams that played today.
Yes, there were a lot of exciting games today, but the most exciting game, in my opinion, was the Senegal versus Ecuador game. Both the teams would advance with a win in that game. Senegal managed to get the win 2-1, and they became the first African team through to the knockout rounds. The Netherlands also beat the host nation Qatar 2-0, and they're also on to the next round. USA and Iran were both in a must-win for both sides as well, and the U.S. were able to secure a 1-0 win to advance to the next round. And lastly, England beat Wales 3-0, and they are also through to the next round.
So this is exciting, Mokbid. Senegal advances to the next round as the first African team. Do you predict any other African teams will make it through to the next round?
Yes, I would have to say that Morocco has a really, really good chance to make it to the next round. They go up against Canada on Thursday, and getting a win against a team at the bottom of their group would secure the spot for them in the next round. They could also get there if Croatia beats Belgium, which are the two other teams that are in their group as well. The other African team that I think has a really good chance of advancing is Ghana. If they beat Uruguay, and Uruguay is a team that has a personal history with Ghana 12 years ago to stop them from reaching the semifinals. So the entire country of Ghana is awaiting this revenge game. So if Ghana is able to win this game, they will then also qualify to the next round.
Can you talk a little about the U.S.-Iran game that just concluded?
The U.S. and Iran game was a must-win for both teams. Iran could have still qualified had they drawn with the U.S., but the U.S. came out, was the more excited team, was the team that was really putting a lot of pressure on Iran. They honestly seemed like they wanted the victory more than Iran did, and they were able to get that 1-0 victory. The U.S. has played really good football the entirety of the tournament. So far in their group stages, they have not lost a game yet. They drew twice, and they won one game. They just haven't been able to score as efficiently as they would have liked to, but nonetheless, they got the job done, and they got out of their group, and they will be playing in the next round of the knockout phase. So kudos to America. They did a great job.
And lastly, what matchups are already confirmed for the round of 16, and how do you see them playing out, Mokbil?
Yes, on Saturday, the Netherlands will go up against the United States. And on Sunday, December 4th, Senegal will play England. I think both games are going to be very exciting. I feel like both games can go either way. Like I said earlier, the U.S. has been playing really, really good football, but they haven't been able to score a bunch of goals, whereas the Dutch haven't been playing that great, but they've been able to score. So, you know, it's kind of like we've seen lapses in the defense for the Dutch here and there, but they've been able to score efficiently. As for the Brits, they've shown us that they can score a bunch of goals, as they did. They scored 6 goals against Iran. They scored 3 against the Wales. But then they've also shown us that Iran was able to score 2 against them. So their defense also in certain moments has shown that you can score against them. So Senegal has played better and better and better every game that they've played. So it'll be very exciting to see the matchup between Senegal and England on Sunday, December 4th.
VOA's on-goal sports analyst, Mokbilia Barro, thank you for your input.
Thank you so much, Hayes.
Sporty greetings. This is VOA's Sonny Young. Brighten your day by tuning in the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. You can also follow the show on Facebook, Twitter, and VOAAfrica.com. It's the sunny side of sports right here on The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel.
What should we make of the impending right-wing government in Israel? Benjamin Netanyahu returns to power, this time with an alliance of some of the most extreme politicians in Israel today. Two Israel experts explain why this happened and implications for the Palestinians, U.S.-Israel relations, and the region, Israel's new government. Next on Encounter, this Saturday and Sunday, on The Voice of America.
Protests have been growing inside and outside Iran, initially sparked by the death in police custody of Mahsa Amini, a young woman arrested by Iran's morality police for not having her hair fully covered. Each Wednesday, go beyond the breaking news with VOA's Flashpoint Iran. Listen online at voanews.com or in your podcast player.
This has been VOA's International Edition. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our websites for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voaafrica.com and voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States participated in the annual Kimberley Process plenary held in November in Gaborone, Botswana. The Kimberley Process is an international multi-stakeholder initiative established in 2003 to prevent the trade of conflict diamonds, defined as diamonds sold by rebel groups or their allies, to finance conflicts against legitimate governments. In a statement outlining U.S. views on this year's plenary meeting, the State Department praised Botswana, whose bid to host the meeting was supported by the United States, for its legacy of mining good governance, which makes it a welcome champion for transparency and accountability in the rough diamond trade. The United States, however, has long been a champion of expanding the definition of a conflict diamond. Every person who wears or uses a diamond should be able to rely on the Kimberley Process to certify its origin from sources that respect human rights at all points of the supply chain. The United States will continue to advocate for that expansion. Another matter of concern at this year's plenary was the abuse of the meeting's consensus-based rules by Russia and Belarus, which blocked participants from discussing the implications of Russia's war on Ukraine and Russia's diamond production under the Kimberley Process. The United States and several like-minded countries had sought to include these issues on the agenda. U.S. Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary in the Bureau of Economic and Business Affairs, Whitney Baird, wrote, "The Russian Federation's premeditated, unprovoked, and unjustified war against the people and government of a fellow KP, Kimberley Process member, cannot be ignored. The KP must assess Russia's compliance with the Kimberley Process minimum requirements, including the fundamental requirement that no conflict diamonds be exported from its territory." While discussion of the issue was blocked, Principal Deputy Baird's letter, as well as letters from other nations, were included in the Kimberley Process's final plenary communique. Finally, the State Department noted that the United States remains gravely concerned with the ongoing conflict in the Central African Republic and the impact on its rough diamond exports. The United States pledged to continue to work with the Carr government to balance the need for legitimate exports with the Kimberley Process mandate to prevent conflict diamonds from entering the commercial supply chain. The United States is committed to a responsible and sustainable diamond industry and will continue to support the Kimberley Process.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.